So this is not something that we normally do on Trek About, but I wanted to mention something briefly. This is the 100th episode.
Yay!
That's it.
Is that the entirety of our celebration?
Yeah.
Well, listeners, there's a surprise for you, because if you send us an email and the 100th email we get, we'll get a free copy of the entire series of Trek About.
That is not a legally binding offer, nor is it correct. Let's talk about Data's Day.
Let's talk about it. I really liked this one.
I figured you would.
This is probably my favorite episode so far, or one of them.
Really?
I really liked this episode. This is,
well, aside from the obvious reasons, what brings you to that conclusion?
I liked it because it was a day in the life on the Enterprise. I really like that kind of a thing. We've always seen what, you know, interesting days are on the Enterprise. We've always seen them from the point of view of whichever character is most directly. You know, that's fairly standard sure. television rules. I like episodes in general. I like episodes when you take a secondary character, when you show what's going on kind of behind the scenes. And this is an episode which, you know, one of the things you always wonder is, well, what's happening between episodes? What are these characters doing during their downtime? When Data's off duty, what is he up to? When what is Crusher doing in a non-medical emergency? You know, I like seeing those moments. You get to see a lot of parts of the ship that we've never been taken into before. They show they're in a store at one point. They're in a nursery. You know, they're in like this garden area.
Arboretum. Yeah.
That's not some place. That's not places that the show usually goes to. And so it makes I like seeing what the Enterprise is as kind of a little world, because this is basically a functioning micro society in its own way, and it's nice to see that from different perspectives.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think this is probably one of the stronger episodes of the show. You know, it's definitely one of my favorites. I really like it. It's entertaining to watch. It gives a lot of good character information about Data and some other people. You know, but what I also like about it is it's a very Next Generation world building episode as well. And you know, I don't think that the Next Generation gets enough credit for its world building. I think the world building that it does is generally pretty good.
Yeah.
And you know, what we see in this episode is we do get to see, like you said, what some characters are doing on their off time. You know, everybody kind of gets their moment. But at the same time, we also get to see how Data is reacting to everybody, which I think is equally as important, right?
Well, this episode, I've always talked about, you know, well, we only can make speculations about what Data is quote unquote feeling, what emotions are like to Data. And this is his most kind of private version of his own feelings. This episode is set up so that we can understand what's going on as the closest to Data's third direct thought pattern.
Yeah.
And we see how emotions actually work for Data. And I mean, this episode only bolsters my assertion that no, he does have emotions. He's either just unaware of them and he's just not an external emoter, but you know, and he may just not be an angry person. He may, you know, but at the very end, he says, I don't understand things like anger and such, but I understand love and friendship. And that's probably that. I mean, this episode makes it very clear that Data is human.
Well, I mean, he's not, but I see what you're saying.
He talks at the end about, you know, maybe humanity is not flesh and blood. Maybe it is a way of thinking, and he's there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of different directions you can take this episode in. And I think the first thing to mention, of course, is that he's writing, like you said, he's writing a letter to Maddox,
which
from Measure of a Man, which is really interesting. It's that subtle way that the show weaves in previous.
Yeah.
Knowledge and previous events without being overbearing about it.
And also does a lot of characterization, not only of Data, but of Maddox. I mean, we learn, you know, based on the fact that he's writing to Maddox about his emotions, we can see where Maddox has changed over the past year or so, you know?
Well, I also think, you know, I think that, you know, that could be. I think the more interesting part of that is that we really do see that Data was sincere in his closing remarks to Maddox at the end of Measure of Man, where he said, you know what, like,
I want to help you. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, let's do this. You know, like if you figure this out, let me know. And Data really comes across in this whole episode as someone who is, probably one of the best parts of humanity, which is he's very open. He's very, he doesn't really hold grudges. He's able to forgive. He's able to help. He's just a very, open person. And
well, just like Worf, you know, because he doesn't feel that he's fully Klingon. He kind of overcompensates and acts to the, kind of the you know, brochure version of Klingon society and ends up being a much better Klingon than most of the Klingons we meet. You know, Data is, it makes sense that Data is a bit more of a better at being human in some ways and the noble characteristics.
Yeah, and I think there's some degrees to which, you know, people react to Data differently than they would react to someone else doing stuff like this, just because they do give him a wide degree of latitude, you know. And I think that you can't forget that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we can say, yes, Data is human and Data has a lot of emotions and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at the end of the day, people are treating him differently than they would, you know, a 35-year-old man.
Yes.
So, you know, for example, that scene where in the barbershop, you know, hello, you lunkhead, or whatever it says. I mean, that's not something
I mean, you know, Data is, I know I've read a couple articles talking about Spock as being, you know, on the autistic spectrum. And I assume that, you know, Data has been interpreted in that way as well.
I mean, I guess. I don't know. I've never heard Spock being.
I've definitely seen that. Yeah.
Well, that's tiresome. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not necessarily
agreeing with it.
No, but at the same time, Data does give resonances of, you know, how people do treat somebody who is, you know, not neurotypical in a way.
Yeah, true.
In a way, they do understand that Data has, you know, differences in them, is better in some ways, is not as, you know, well-formed emotionally as, you know, they may, or not as sophisticated, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the exact term, you know, I want to use, because I want to be fairly neutral here. But so, yes, they are acting differently around him, but they're in a way that I think respects him. You know what I mean? Like, they understand that, you know, Data says, you know, hello, you belong, kid. And they know, you know, and then he says, well, I'm experimenting with, you know, various things. And then, okay, it's Data being Data, and, you know, that's okay, you know.
But, you know, I think it's interesting, though, because I think that if it was Lore doing that, they would react very negatively. And I think that that's the key, because it's not just that they're giving Data latitude because he is autistic or whatever, but they're also giving him latitude because they know what a decent person he is.
That's true,
on a fundamental level, and so they give him allowances for that.
Yeah
And I also think, you know, it's interesting that Data seems to, you know, Data's the only character that's awake 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, why we're following him around, I think. If you want to do a day in the life of the Enterprise, do it with Data, just because he is going to be around for the whole day. And we do see, you know, we see the day side, the night side, etc. I do think it's interesting that Data seems to work more than other people, because, you know, of course, the implication in the episode is that he is in command of the Enterprise for the 8 hours that they're in the night shift, and he's also around on the day shift too, in ops. So that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. He doesn't need to rest, really.
He doesn't need to sleep.
He doesn't need to necessarily have recreation. If, you know, if a person were to work that intensely, they would, you know, probably have a, you know, they would need a vacation.
It does raise the question of whether that's something he's chosen to do or not, though. You know, like, is it just that because he doesn't need sleep, they say, okay, well, normally you'd get 16 hours off, 8 hours to sleep and 8 hours to do what you want.
Yeah.
We'll just give you 8 hours off because you don't need to sleep, so you need to work
24
hours
on call. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird, right? I don't know what it's a question I have.
Yeah,
basically.
The implication then is that during these 8 hours, you know, he's 100%, and, you know, at any other time, if he's called, you know, if they need him, they'll call him, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's of course what life is like in the military anyway, but, you know, I just think it's interesting that as a matter of course, he seems to have 16-hour days. That's a side point, though. And I think that what you see in this episode is Data grappling with how best to reveal parts of himself to different people, you know, because
yeah,
Crusher, for instance, seems very surprised that he would want to get married.
Yeah.
You know, this is not anything that he's ever said before. Right. So,
I mean, I'm surprised that he wants to get married in a way, but
I mean, are you though?
In a way, yes. And in a way, no.
Nice hedging.
Thank you. I mean, we see him, you know, in the episode with Lal, of course, he, you know, he desires to have a child. So certainly, but I don't know that if, I guess I kind of, that whole incident made me, I don't know. He wants to have a child, but he kind of skipped the getting married part in a way. And I guess that kind of didn't seem like it was on his agenda in a way.
I mean, well, yeah, I guess, but I think that there's a degree to which, you know, Data does what Data wants to do.
Yes.
I don't think that he's really trying to live up to some sort of script. And I also
And I'm not saying like, no, he needed to get married in order to have a kid.
Right.
He seems to go to the extending himself rather than finding companionship, you know, first like that. And so that seems the stronger need to me, I guess, is where that goes.
But it could, you know, it's interesting though that you bring the offspring up, because of course you could make the argument, and perhaps I will make the argument, or maybe I'm being devil's advocate here, but that he does what is open to him at the time,
and that is another.
And so Data getting into a romantic relationship and possibly getting married is a lot more difficult than Data constructing another Soong android. As crazy as that sounds,
no. But I mean, he talks to Crusher about this and says, you know, I'm not going to get old. You know, if he marries somebody who is biological, no matter how long-lived they may be, and there are some very long-lived species in this galaxy, you know, the implication is that Data can continue indefinitely. And
yeah.
Unless he marries an energy being or something like that, and I would not approve of that match at all. You know,
He would probably be a good match for the companion that we saw all the way back in Metamorphosis.
Oh my God. Is that one of the movies? Because that would be terrible.
It is. That is what Star Trek Insurrection is all about.
More like in suck action.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, you see that throughout the episode as well, because what Data is dealing with, of course, is the through line of O'Brien and Keiko's wedding,
yeah.
Of course. And, you know, I step back for a second and talk about this episode as a whole, because I think it's very well constructed.
Oh, yeah.
And everything feels very satisfying and it's all wrapped up very nicely. And you've got these through lines throughout the episode that are not dropped at all. I mean, contrast that with what we talked about last
yeah.
week with like Final Mission, for example, where things were just dropped
yeah.
here and there. This episode, everything is pretty
it
much
has
picked
a lot.
Up at the
it
end.
It has the wedding. It has the Juarez baby. It has the dancing. It has the, you know, there.
The wedding.
The wedding. It has the whole Romulan Vulcan, you know, that plot. What I really liked actually about all of these plots was that they're very skeletal in a way. I mean, it's the entire Romulan ambassador, you know, whatever. What's her name?
T'Pol. T'Pol is someone else. T'Pol is this person.
I don't even know what Picard's name is. It's Kirk. I know that.
Yes,
but that's
it's
only because I looked it up. No, I mean, the whole T'Pol plot line is very kind of just, it's almost an impression of a regular Star Trek plot, because you can see a version of this episode which is following that entire plot line and Data's, you know, adventures, you know, getting the wedding back together as the B plot. And, you know, you can see,
but they flipped the script.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so you're only given these really brief moments of this big conspiracy that's going on. I mean, this implies years and years of a deep cover agent who was pretending to be a completely different species, you know, this entire time. And they had this conflict. Yeah. And it's just, it's almost glossed over because it's kind of not the point of it. We see enough to know what's going on here, but they don't overstay their welcome. And as a result, they're allowed to make this a very dense episode in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, we even have, you know, moments like we're at the very beginning. He's saying, you know, there's, you know, the Hindu Festival of Lights and, you know, we've got all these people, you know, and he mentions like, you know, seven or eight things that are happening. Well, not seven or eight, but he mentions several things that are happening. And so this feels like a very busy ship. And a lot is going on kind of independent of each other.
Yeah, and I don't think that you would want to see this kind of episode all the time.
No.
But I think, you know, step back every once in a while and do an episode like this, and it really does make the show, you know, in the world feel richer, because we get a sense of what's going on outside of the bridge and outside of the main characters.
That's it. I mean, you picture, then in a way you can kind of, in later episodes that I watch, I will probably picture, you know, well, if Crusher's not in this episode, you know, well, this, she's probably, you know, she could be delivering a baby, you know, if Data's not around there, you know, he's hanging out with Keiko and they're, you know, in the Arboretum. Like, you know, there's all these, we, you know, O'Brien, we only see him through very brief bits here and there in the rest of the series, but now we know that this entire time he has been dating this woman and, you know, they've been getting very close and proposing marriage. And this is the first we're hearing of it, but it fits.
Yeah, which, you know, it's funny. I have two thoughts about that. Number one is, I think that's right, and I want to take it a step further, where it's like, you know, when you're in a, you know, next week when we're back, you know, or next episode or whatever, when we're back in the regular show again, you know, Riker will not be on the bridge, but we'll have an idea of maybe what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, like, Geordi is not there. Maybe he's getting a haircut. Like, you kind of get to see these things happening, and it's nice.
You know, and his barber are really friendly, and that, you know, and again, that gives him a bit more of characterization of them in a way that the show doesn't usually have the room to see.
Yeah, exactly. And I like that, you know, because if you kind of interjected that scene in an episode that was, you know, more serious, I think it would feel out of place. But in this episode, it's just a slice of life.
And it gives all, I love that there's a lot of background shit. Like in that, the scene in the salon, I loved the little moment where the guy just dyes the woman's hair with this like wand, you know, when they're in the store, you know, you see this kid getting a teddy bear. Like you, they did a lot in the background.
I think it was a rabbit, actually.
It's some kind of stuffed animal.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do a lot in the background, like, of that. Again, this is a very vibrant, busy ship.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you really see that in this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned Keiko and O'Brien, because, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of pat. You know, if you watch this, I think it's interesting, because I'm going to step back for a second and say, you know, you used to criticize the original series, and you even used to criticize The Next Generation for, I think, not being what television is like now.
Yeah.
And you don't do that anymore, number one.
Because this is the vast majority of television I'm watching. Like, folks, right now, Breaking Bad's done. Mad Men's on, you know, hiatus right now. Like, there's, I don't really watch any other shows. So, yeah, this is, I am getting more used to these plot lines.
But I think, you know, on the one hand, you look at this and you say, this is not something that television could get away with anymore, right?
No.
Like, they could not just suddenly introduce a character who was marrying another character out of thin air. That would just not
happen. Unless they
made
it be like, oh, you just met her 3 days ago. You know, like, they if they had one of those, that, you know, they would have to put that in the dialogue and make it about that.
But I think, you know, it works, number one, because, again, it is a show of a certain era that they just did that kind of thing sometimes.
Yeah.
But I also think it works because it's O'Brien. Like, it wouldn't work if Keiko was marrying Riker.
Yeah,
right?
Or even Geordi or anyone like that. Like, we would have seen them.
We would have been like, where was this person?
Yeah.
But suddenly what we get is we get a different dimension here. I like the fact that, frankly, we get to see a professional woman doing something. I mean, even though she's acting, you know, and whatever, she's what a cold feet. I mean, it would have been, I think, a little more nice if they had flipped the script and had O'Brien have cold feet, because that's just kind of, you know, women be crazy. It's a minor criticism of the episode, but it is a criticism I have. Keiko is, we will see her again. So it's a characterization that kind of locks in the character to a certain degree. And I think a lot of people are unfair to Keiko.
Okay.
But I think that there's also some bad stuff there as well.
You know, I like that, you know, she and Data, is that the thing? I don't necessarily picture someone very irrational knowing, you know, being friends with Data in a way. Like, so you get, I almost got the sense that, like, you know, again, he wandered into the Arboretum one day for a thing and, you know, they became friendly and, like, he hangs out there when he has nothing to do, you know? And yeah, like, and I got the sense that this was just her just jitters on the eve of her wedding. It's not an impossible thing. thought they were going to go into a bit more of her feelings and why she's feeling that way, you know. But again, it doesn't necessarily need to.
I don't think they do that just because I don't think that's the point of the episode. The point of the episode is to see what Data is seeing.
Yeah.
And so Data's not really going to be privy to that. And frankly, it's not important to the episode.
No. What's more important is that he took from that, you know, when she says, look, tell O'Brien, you know, I'll be happier with, you know, we'll be happier with you at each other. And he takes that at face value. And he thinks, you know, well, O'Brien will be happy because it's going to make her happy, you know, and that'll make everybody happy. Like, you know, it's this episode is a lot of him realizing exceptions to rules in a way about, you know, human behavior. And I think realizing human behavior as a series of exceptions to rules, because humans never follow the rules when it comes to their emotions.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. You know, and frankly, too, I think that it allows Data to, I think, grow and change as a character within a self-contained episode that, you know, will probably never be mentioned again.
Yeah.
Or if it will, it will be mentioned very obliquely, but that we will know and that we will remember and that we will know that he's doing this kind of thing in the background. And, you know, Data is the kind of person who has a cat, you know, like, it's
I love that feline formula 73, you know? Yeah. And the way he interacts with his cat, and I mean, that's very significant. That means a lot, that he's the kind, yeah, that he wants to have a pet, that he considers that. Because everything a lot of what Data does is in service of being human. You can tell he thinks humans have pets. I'm going to have a pet.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways, you know, this episode is about Data learning that omitting information is almost as bad as not understanding, right? Because he omits information a lot of times in this episode, and it doesn't go well for him, like with the dancing, you know?
Yeah.
And we get that great scene of them tap dancing, which is fun. God. And then, you know, she finds out that it's actually for a wedding and she freaks out. Stuff like that, he's learning how to talk to people, I think.
I mean, yeah, most important, I, you know, and this is why I say no, Data does have, you know, feelings and emotion, because when he's saying the, you know, he meets the ambassador and she says, oh, I was just testing your your safeguards, you know, and obviously she's fishing for as much information as, you know, she can get. And, sure, you know, if he had immediately gone to the captain and reported it, you know, they would have discovered the plot a lot earlier. But, you know, and he says that, you know, if I had a gut instinct, you know, I would have, you know, done something about this, but I don't have a gut instinct. But the fact that he's even going into that line of thinking
means that he
has it, and he's disregarding it because he's told that he doesn't have these emotions.
Right. Or like the scene on the bridge when he's tapping his fingers and he looks at his hand like, what am I doing?
He's terrified. You know, that's the closest he's get to terrified. Now, he may not have that, you know, icy feeling. He may not be panicking. He may not be unable to act from that, but he is still recognizing that this is a very dangerous situation and that the entire ship is in danger, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, if that's not being scared, I don't really know what is. He's doing it in a very calm way, but he is still scared.
And also, I think, you know, it's you know, about that as well, is that he does say at one point in one of the voiceovers that he has a lot in common with Vulcans, but he doesn't appreciate their what does he call it? Like their Stark philosophy or something.
Yeah. And you know, the Vulcans deny emotion, you know, emotions that they have. And, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, Data talks about how he doesn't understand irony, but his life is defined by a lot of ironies. And, you know, the fact that he, you know, has emotions and yet doesn't realize them is ironic. The fact that he doesn't like this, you know, he doesn't understand why the Vulcans wouldn't embrace emotions if they had it. I think he kind of views, if I had access to this, something as rich and as deep as Vulcan emotions were, I would be doing that every day. I would be gleeful. I would be happy. I would be angry. I would be feeling this full gamut. And yet he doesn't, in a way, I don't know if it's he doesn't allow himself, he doesn't understand it, or again, he just isn't a very emotive person in a way, but he does have those emotions.
Well, I think it really highlights the fact that we all sort of, you know, form our worldviews and color our perceptions based on what is around us, and, you know, our own experiences and our own histories. Because, you know, Data has probably studied the history of Vulcan and knows exactly why they abandoned, you know, emotions for logic, but he doesn't have like sort of the gut cultural upbringing of that. And so he looks at Vulcans and he says, well, I understand why they're like this, but I don't like it myself. Because in a sense, he can't, because he's surrounded by humans all the time. Yeah. And he sees how they react to their emotions and what emotions bring them. If Data had been discovered on a Vulcan colony and had been turned on Vulcan and had lived on Vulcan for 30 years, he might be a very different person.
Hell, if he'd been raised on Beta Zed.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he even thinks that, like, well, if I were a Vulcan, you know, if I had the access to Vulcan, he would keep some under control, because again, I don't see any version of Data that would be the life of the party.
No.
But at the same time, I think he would be a little less controlled. He would be a Vulcan that smiles, you know?
Well, he smiles in this episode.
And yeah, I love his smile in this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that could be. And I think, you know, I don't know if control is the right word, because I don't know that Data is deliberately controlling himself. I just think that that's the way he is. And, you know, he's always learning about himself. And this episode is about him learning about himself and providing information to Maddox to perhaps, you know, build another android and learn from that. But at the end of the day, you know, all of this sort of like coalesces in the background, I think, and you have all of these things happening with Lol and her emotions and Data and how he's understanding things and telling Maddox, and Maddox is doing this work, and, you know, the difference between Vulcans and humans and how they interact with each other and how they interact with their own species and stuff like that. It's all very sort of, it doesn't ever really go anywhere, but it's still satisfying, because it you can kind of sink your teeth into it, and there's a lot to think about. And I think that's what the nice part of it is, really.
This episode, because it is such a, you know, relatively standard episode, not standard, but like it's a
non-standard.
Yeah. But I mean, like this is because it's funny. This is what most of their day to days would be, you know?
Yeah.
And so this would be just a day in the life episode. You know, there can be things that are just for characterization. This is a Data characterization episode. So even if something doesn't completely go anywhere or have a payoff, well, we still learn something about him. And so that is itself a payoff.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And, you know, I guess the final thing to say about this episode is, you know, they do weave a lot of the continuity in. And I do like the fact that there is a, you know, in the broad strokes, this episode features Romulans and a wedding. And so it is kind of like Balance of Terror.
Yeah.
And even to the point where what Picard says at the wedding vows are very close to what Kirk says in that episode.
Yeah, they both say it's the privilege of the captain to, when since the days of the sailing ships, you know. That maybe almost makes me think, like, it's kind of rich. I don't know. That's what the Starfleet wedding ceremony may be. I mean, maybe that's kind of the
speech,
and that's nice. I mean, it's itself a very, you know, poetic, you know, formulation. I mean, even since, you know, when Kirk said it, it was a very nice scene, you know.
It provides a level of historicity to the episode, which I think is nice.
Yeah.
And it also provides a sort of continuity for Data as well, because of course Data is a part of Starfleet and
yes.
He's learning a lot about this, and it makes you think about other things as well, like Spock, for example, and stuff like that.
So I did some research day for this episode.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready.
You know what I learned?
What?
Okay. So the tap dancing scene, and I was thinking, okay, you know, they probably used a lot of doubles, but they are actually dancing for a lot of that. Well, it turns out the overhead shot was a double.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else was the two of them, and Gates McFadden was apparently a choreographer before she was an actress, which I didn't know. So that was actually kind of awesome. So this was basically, you know, they wanted to give her an opportunity to dance on the show, you know, and they got it. And I think my favorite line from this episode was, you know, I don't want to be known as the dancing doctor again. Because then you suddenly learn what her college was like.
Yeah, there's a lot of nice little moments throughout the episode for that.
Again, this is whoever wrote this episode knows these characters really well and knows just little incidental stuff about their routines and about their backgrounds. And just, again, who would have known that Dr. Crusher was a dancer, you know, in her youth? But it makes sense in a way as a random thing she did.
I think now that you're doing research, I think we may need to think about having some sort of graduation ceremony for you.
Oh my God, it's our 100th episode.
The show may not be accurate anymore. Yeah. You may be a Trek fan now.
I may be a newbie Trekkie.
Yeah, yeah. But you still provide a level of interesting context to the discussion that I find intriguing.
Thank you.
I hope the listeners find intriguing.
And if you do, email us. And then if you're the 100th emailer, we're going to give you a full series run of Trek About.
That is not happening. It's never going to happen. Just download them yourself. All right. I will give this one 10 tap dances.
I was going to give it 10 Juarez babies.
Oh, that's nice. And
let me tell you, I hate babies. That was a fucking cute baby. It didn't cry. It wasn't shitting itself. It was just like, I'm a little baby. Look at me.
Yeah. That baby is now dead.
Oh my God. It was so long ago.
Yeah. They're like dogs. They only live for 15 years or so.
Oh.
All right, let's move on to The Wounded. I guess that somebody decided that they wanted to give O'Brien a lot to do.
I know. I love the O'Brien show. It's kind of like, you know, a show within a show.
It seems kind of sitcom-y in a way.
Yeah. I mean, they don't dwell too much on the wacky adventures of O'Brien and Keiko. They do use it kind of to get some insight into, you know, O'Brien's thought process on this one. I mean, with her, he ends up dealing with his, you know, leftover feelings towards the war and all of that, which is good. That's fine as a way to get into character. But here's my question about, so their argument this week is about how he doesn't like sushi and she doesn't like potatoes. And what are they going to do? You know, There's a replicator. They are talking, you know, about how they make food from the replicator. Like, she, you know, Keiko is astonished to find out, you know, that people, you know, still cook in a way. So they're obviously replicating these. Why do they have to eat the same thing?
Well, actually, that's a good question. There's a Federation law that states that if you're a married couple, you have to eat the same foods.
That's really weird. So what about, like,
it's a socialist society.
I understand that. But, I mean, if they're just, like, cohabitating.
Well, no. If you're cohabitating, it's fine. You can eat whatever you want. But if you're married specifically, the law states that you have to eat the same food.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So, like, why? What's the advantage of getting married in this society?
Mostly tax breaks, which is weird because there's no money.
There's no money.
Yeah.
So, basically, I think it's a downside that they got married, and they might end up getting divorced for practical reasons.
Yes, actually, in the next episode.
That's actually a really cool, like, arc. It's fairly dark for the series, but that said, it's also very progressive of it.
So, what do you make of O'Brien? Because they seem to be trying to make him more of a character, which is interesting, because he is a character that goes back to the pilot. He didn't have a name for, I think, a season. And he's slowly becoming not a main character, but definitely
a sort of
it's kind of a character trope that the Next Generation hasn't really done before, which is a recurring character.
Yeah,
now, they have Guinan, but aside from that, I mean, they don't really do that.
And she's a recurring guest star in her way,
right? It's Whoopi Goldberg.
Yes, exactly. I mean, when Q is coming on, he's John DeLancey playing Q. You know what I mean? O'Brien is never a special guest star. He's neither in importance nor in, you know, the actor's, you know, position or anything like that. But I mean, it's to the effect of when we see him and Keiko having dinner together, it's not like we're, well, who the hell is this? You know, we know who, you know, they're it's somebody that they've been using a while, and they don't just make up a different character each time, which, like, the original series did, and this series does sometimes too.
Sometimes, yeah.
You just need a character to fill in a role while you create one for the purposes of it. And even Keiko seemed like she was created for the purposes in Day to Day, but now she's going to be a recurring character as well, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely.
If not as much focus on her as him. I mean, part of it seems almost inevitable in a way. I mean, we are spending a lot of time with all of these characters. As the series is going further and further, it's naturally kind of wanting to get into their heads and wanting to see. I mean, in general, we're seeing more of their off-duty lives, all of the characters. This series is very interested in that, in who they are off the battlefield as well as on. And I think it's just that general interest is focusing on to the recurring characters. They may have given O'Brien a recurring role just to have, you know, a friendly face in the transport room and to not have to worry about finding an extra each time. You know, it may have been practical reasons, but he's there and we want to know who he is. We like I mean, I like the scenes that O'Brien is in usually. I'm not sure where they're going to go with it. You've almost implied that that kind of outwears its welcome, and I can see, again, if they're doing the
I don't know that I've implied that.
I don't know. If they're doing the Keiko and O'Brien show, you know, that might not be the best thing, but...
That's actually the spinoff. It's not Star Trek Deep Space Nine. It's Star Trek Miles O'Brien and Keiko.
I would watch that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, you know, like in Data's Day, they wanted to show a variety of actions happening on the Enterprise. And so a wedding was, of course, I think, a logical thing to have happen. That's something that, you know, I don't know how many percentage of humanity gets married, but it's a high percentage. That's a very common...
It's at once common and special in a way.
Special, common. Yeah, exactly. Right. And so it made sense. I mean, we said that, of course, they kind of had to find a character that wasn't a main character to get married that could have a girlfriend or a boyfriend that was off screen, because they wouldn't have gotten away with that with Riker or someone like that. And so it may, you know, okay, fine, let's pick O'Brien. O'Brien's been in the show. They've been slowly developing his character over the past 3.5 years. So let's find out more about him. Let's marry him off and see what happens. I think it's interesting that the next episode is The Wounded, because this is an episode that has to do a lot of stuff. It has to establish the Cardassians right away
as
some sort of threat, and also as some species that the Federation has history with, even though we have never heard of them before. It also has to establish the Keiko and O'Brien relationship a little bit. And then I also think it's an interesting choice to use O'Brien as... kind of the main character in the episode. This is an O'Brien episode. And as far as I can recall, this is the first episode of the show that has had the first character that's had an episode in the show that hasn't been a main character. And so you've got a lot of interesting stuff going on here, and a lot of heavy lifting has to be done by this episode specifically. I think it pulls it off. I think it's I don't want to beat around the bush. I think this is a good episode. I don't know how you felt about it.
I liked
it,
but... I mean, I think giving it to O'Brien was a very wise choice, because it... If you had just given it to a random any person, that would kind of make the viewer's feelings towards the Cardassians a little less neutral. I mean, here we see that O'Brien is dealing with scars from the war. He's somebody we like. He's somebody who we're automatically sympathetic to, in a way which I think the episode needs to be. We need to understand that this was a very horrific war, and that, you know, there is widespread, if not, you know, there is widespread distrust of the Cardassians. You know, it's a species that the Federation is at peace with, but everybody kind of knows is a very uneasy peace. It's not a correct opinion to kind of announce that feeling, but it's something that's kind of under the surface of everybody in a way that it isn't with the Romulans or the Klingons. I mean, I think it's funny that at one point, even Worf says, like, you know, oh, we can't trust the Cardassians. You know, they've been, you know, when the Klingons and the Federation were once bitter enemies and, you know, are now at peace. I mean, that he, I mean, his when he says that, it's almost an ignorance of that fact in a way, which at this point we don't view Klingons really as enemies. But
yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, to that point, the reason why it's interesting that O'Brien is sort of the main character of the episode, he's given this history with the Cardassians in a direct way. He's given this history with Captain Maxwell, who he served under on a different ship. And interestingly enough, he also was the tactical officer, so he seems to have taken a step down from that. He was the wharf of that ship, and now he's the transporter chief. All right. But O'Brien's history has always been a little messed up. I mean, he kind of goes between ranks, and his backstory changes. I mean, you know, we don't want to step back and think that The Next Generation was planned out or anything. This was very much a television show of its time, and so they were just doing things on the fly a lot of the time.
Yeah.
We're
not supposed to really pay attention to, you know, whether it was a demotion or not. It's just that was his old job, and now this is his new job.
Yeah, exactly. We're not really supposed to logically think about it. But I think that, you know, it's interesting to choose O'Brien, because I think in a way it's a good choice because we're the least familiar with him, even though we are familiar with him. Because basically all you know about O'Brien is he's a friendly guy who helps you out. And that I don't think that giving the history to someone who we know a lot about, say Riker was in this, you know, the main character in this episode or something. We know that Riker has these different opinions of other races, and we know that he has sort of like dark sides to him, as do all of the main characters, you know. But O'Brien is just your friendly transporter chief. And so to find out that he has these problems with a species that, you know, frankly, we don't have any relationship with, we don't know anything about them. I think it's really, you know, it kind of works to highlight the differences in the different approaches that characters have to different species, and also, frankly, to maybe make us not be sympathetic to O'Brien's point of view, but think about his point of view a little more.
Yeah, I think that's a better way of phrasing
it. Because this is an episode about racism, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because it doesn't really... the ending ends in such this ambiguous clusterfuck. I mean, the other captain is dead wrong for the ways in which he, you know, went about this. I mean, there is no question that he went rogue and he, you know, deserves to be sanctioned for that. But there is also no question that the Cardassians are preparing for war, and that while what he did was wrong, the reasons he did it turned out to be completely correct. And yet there is Picard's also saying, like, look, you know, I'm there to preserve the peace. Like, it doesn't really matter what you're doing, but that, you know, this was not to end in war. And if it, you know, I mean, need to let this go.
Well, I think it's I have a slightly different read on that. I think that, you know, that last scene with Picard and Galmaset is great. And really, it's, you know, Picard is the father figure of the show, really. And he always has been. And he's the one who is very, very thoughtful. And so what happens with Maxwell is you know, the episode is really, a lot of it is about how people that get involved in wars, they come back from war and they're changed and they can't reintegrate into peaceful society. Now, of course, it's a little different because Maxwell and O'Brien are both still in active duty in Starfleet. They're not living on Earth on a farm or something. They didn't go back to their hometown and have PTSD, you know, stuff. Yeah,
but there's a difference between a wartime army and a peacetime army.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, what you see is really that Maxwell is a very different captain than Picard. He is one who has this firsthand combat experience. You know, Picard says that he was chased by a Cardassian ship once, but it doesn't sound like Picard was deeply involved in the Cardassian War.
Yeah.
Whereas it sounds like Maxwell was. And so he has a different framing from the Cardassians than Picard does. What Maxwell is seeing is, oh, well, you know, they told us the war was over, but we know we can't trust the Cardassians because of this. And he doesn't want to trust Starfleet with this information. So he goes after the Cardassians in the only way that he knows how. Whereas Picard,
in a way, is kind of a Kirk.
Well,
in that he sees something that needs to be done and he does it.
Yes and no. I don't think that Kirk would single-handedly go off and kill 700 people.
That he would not do.
So that's the step. In a way, he's more like Decker from the Doomsday Machine, I think.
Okay.
And so you kind of get the Kirk. I think that's an interesting, you know, interpretation, but I think the Kirk thing is one step further. Where would Kirk go if Kirk didn't have a moral center or a compass, right? And so what I like about that is, you know, Picard could very easily be played for a fool. And I think Maxwell thinks Picard is a fool, right? Because he has that line about, oh, it smells like a bureaucrat's office in here. And he obviously doesn't trust people that are behind desks. Whereas, you know, I think Maxwell is very much predisposed to think poorly of Picard, no matter what Picard says.
Yeah.
The only thing that Maxwell could, you know, Picard could win over Maxwell if Picard was like, fuck yeah, let's go kill some Cardies. That's not going to happen, obviously. And so at the very end of the episode, when Picard is really saying, you know what, he was right, though. You know, I'm not a fool. Starfleet is not a fool. We will be watching you. We know what you're going to be doing. And so that, I think, is more indicative of a uneasy, it's almost like a Cold War situation, you know, and that's what the Federation really gets into all these times, is that, you know, they have to keep watching the Romulans even though they're at peace. They have to watch the Cardassians even though they're at peace. It's constructing, I think, even a different Federation than we've seen in the first few seasons of the show.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Federation, I was thinking, like, if the Cardassians and the Romulans decided to team up, I mean, the Federation would be fucked. You see, the Federation is... Does that happen?
No.
Oh.
I always have mixed feelings about how close to play things to the vest. And I will only say this. Pay attention to this episode because the Cardassians are a...
I know they recur.
They become an integral part of the Star Trek mythology.
Okay, I didn't know how significant... I mean, they're one of those species whose names I've heard before. I assume they had to have a role similar to the Romulans, something like that, like, or that in terms of significance. I'm not quite sure.
I would say the Cardassians, if you look at the Romulans, and certainly we can talk about this when we get through the entire franchise, which will happen in approximately 30 years.
Well, Eric, we finished Voyager.
So Enterprise to do. What are we, 80?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
We took a few years off.
I would say that the Romulans never really gel completely as an alien species in the show. I think they're always kind of underbaked. The franchise never really knows what to do with Romulans in a sense, and they're never really fully fleshed out. The Cardassians are very fleshed out, and I think the Cardassians become much more important to the franchise than the Romulans ever were or are.
Okay. Well, that's kind of cool then.
And also their makeup gets better.
Oh, good, because...
the makeup in this episode was kind of sloppy.
I mean, here's the thing. What I liked about it is that they imply that the two, you know, under officers or whatever, like, I think they're a little more, I don't know. It's hard to read Cardassians, but I do get the sense that the people who are a little closer to the ground might feel similarly. I mean, the one that wants to go for a drink with O'Brien does seem sincere enough about, you know, well, it's, you know, why not? Why don't we, you know, we have to work together. I'm not really comfortable here either. We're really kind of dealing with the same stuff, but we don't want to be at war. Like, I think the average Cardassian on the street, you know, tends to feel that way, that their, you know, hostilities are over and we don't want to do that again.
Yeah, that could certainly be. And I think, you know, what that scene is really supposed to illustrate, because, you know, again, this is an episode about prejudice and about how people, you know, you could look at, you know, American history and think about how people felt about Japanese people after World War II or how people feel about Muslims now, for example. As you always get this sense of during wartime, you have to other your enemy, and they're not really people, and they're not really anybody that you should care about or ascribe, you know, emotions or motivations or internal lives to at all. And, you know, what you're really getting is you're seeing that, you know, O'Brien never really thought about that before.
Yeah.
He never really thought about the fact that maybe Cardassians would be uncomfortable on the Enterprise. And why shouldn't they be, frankly? I mean, you know, I put it to you this way, the episode doesn't make this explicit, but I get the sense that O'Brien is not the only person on the Enterprise that is uncomfortable having Cardassians on the ship.
I think even Troy mentions at one point, like, there's a general unease or something like that. Like, I mean, one of the things I like about the O'Brien Keiko thing is that they do have this conversation, you know, over dinner when they're talking. I mean, they're talking completely about Maximilian and, you know, saying, oh, and he's saying, you know, he must have these feelings, but the war is over.
Maximilian.
Maxwell.
Yeah.
Richard
just has his own Star Trek naming system going on here. Anyway,
when Maxine, you know, they're talking about Admiral Maxine, and they're basically saying, you know, he, you know, and Keiko obviously knows that O'Brien is talking about himself. And I like that they, you know, even though I think it's nice that they do have that kind of level of communication in that. I mean, this is, you know, they're used as a way to further this Cardassian plot, but the characterization of that marriage is actually kind of nice in that way.
Yeah, and it's also funny because I think on a show that doesn't have a lot of female characters in general and certainly doesn't have a lot of strong, fully fleshed out female characters, you know, I like what we've seen of Keiko so far. Well, like we said previously, Data's Day, perhaps a little, you know, maybe a little shrewish, but that was maybe a misfire. I think that in this episode, it goes a long way towards maybe redeeming her a little bit.
I get the sense that they, that will be retroactively explained as, you know, a wedding day freak out in a way and, you know, her acting out of character.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think it's nice that they're able to very quickly establish what their relationship is like, even though we've only ever seen Keiko twice.
Yeah.
And I like her. You know, I think she's a fine character. We don't know a lot about her, but the Barth that we've seen is this relationship makes sense. And she's a good sounding board for O'Brien. And she's, you know, she's also smart, as you said, because she's able to pick up that O'Brien is really talking about himself, frankly.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting that the Keiko O'Brien marriage subplot in this episode revolves around food and culture and how we think about culture in regards to food as well, because, you know, O'Brien is very much a person who likes what he likes and he feels uncomfortable with Keiko's food. You know, it's a little on the nose.
Well,
let's go
to the scene in 10 forward when the Cardassian orders some kind of liquor and, you know,
Kanar,
and, you know, O'Brien just orders a nail. He says, oh, I never developed taste for that. And, you know, the Cardassian is like, yeah, it takes a while, you know. I mean, that's the same other line there. I mean, they you know, but I think the episode does suggest that while food is an indicator of, you know, culture, the entire series has used that as a metaphor. I mean, alien food is an extremely important, actually, metaphor in the series. When you have Riker on the Klingon ship, it's a big deal that he's able to eat Klingon food. When you have Worf and his parents and, you know, he refused to eat human food and I had to make blood pudding or whatever for him, you know, that's a big thing.
Yeah. Hell, go back all the way to the original series with an episode like Amok Time where Nurse Chapel is making, you know, Spock plomeek soup.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like this comforting thing, right? It's kind of recurring motif throughout the series, the franchise.
Having a food, one's own culture food is seen as a comfort factor, as a way of home, but eating another's is a way of accepting that culture. That Pulaski does the tea ceremony.
Yeah.
You know, that's even an expression of that.
But think about what does it mean that a Federation ship would even have Kanar or would have the molecular structure of it to replicate it? You know, like if the reverse had been happening and O'Brien was on the Cardassian ship, do you think the Cardassian ship would be able to give him an ale? I don't know.
It depends on how common Kanar is. I get the sense it's an obscure but not, you know, completely inaccessible drink. I mean, you know, the conversation implies that it's not the first, you know, O'Brien has had the opportunity to have Kanar before.
I mean, Kanar is basically, you know, the Cardassian whiskey or something.
Yeah, I guess it's to the effect of someone goes to a bar and orders like Uzu or something like that. You know, it's a very specific drink, but a well-stocked bar will probably have it. You know, the Federation starship is going to have it.
Yeah. And then also think, you know, on that same line, you know, think about how O'Brien is able to get to Maxwell. You know, he gets to Maxwell by singing a very old Irish fighting song. I mean, it's funny because we don't really get a sense of who O'Brien is as a person until this episode. And what we get, I think, is someone who is very conservative. You know, he doesn't like to change. He doesn't like to be outside of his comfort zone. And I think it's to the show's credit that could have been something that was seen as small-minded or perhaps a little old-fashioned. But in his characterization, it's just seen as a facet of his personality, and it doesn't necessarily mean that he is rigid.
No, but at the same time, I think O'Brien is the kind of person who wants to have his little place in his way, in a way that's comfortable. And I think, you know, he has a job that's kind of tangential to adventure. I think it's, I mean, hell, we talk about why would he, you know, accept a demotion. Maybe after the war, he just decided, you know, I really just don't want to be in a place of action anymore. And he goes to the technical side, you know.
Yeah.
He's always just had an aptitude for machinery. And, you know, that's how, he's in the teleportation room. He knows enough about what's going on. He gets a lot of good work stories. He sees a lot of, you know, foreign dignitaries and stuff like that, but he doesn't actually have to do that much. I think he likes a comfortable life.
I think that could be, yeah. And I mean, also, frankly, the fact of the matter is that he fell in love and married a woman who was not Irish, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's not incidental as well. I mean,
no.
there is a part of him that does want to be challenged, I think, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the song that, you know, they're talking about, that song, and that's the one that he tells her, you know, we used to sing that in the war, and you know, it's one of those sad Irish drinking songs where you lament old comrades. And, you know, I think that, you know, he has to sing that with Captain Maxwell, because that's kind of that's the moment. I mean, and it's after that point that Maxwell realizes that the war is indeed over. That's kind of his closure song.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. But also, I think it's interesting that, you know, Maxwell and Picard are contrasted in this episode, as we said, but, you know, think about Picard's actions sort of in the middle of the episode, because I don't think the show is afraid to have Picard make mistakes.
I mean, and
that could be something that a lesser show would make Picard infallible. And I think that it goes a long way towards, I think, Galmaset making the mistaken assumption that Picard is not with it, right? Because, you know, Picard is chasing after the Phoenix, but he's going pretty slow, and, you know, he doesn't really see, he seems very indecisive, and Galmaset basically has to tell him what to do.
I don't know to what degree. I'm trying to think of the point in which Picard figures out the Cardassian plot, and I think it's before Maxwell tells him, you know. From when Picard says, you know, to Galmaset, like, you know putting our science base there, come on, that's like, he basically implies that he figured it out fairly quickly. He didn't go for too long without, I think maybe he might have misunderestimated Maxwell's willingness to fire on another ship again.
That could be too.
I think that's a lot of it. Like, he just kind of figured, well, you know, and maybe he gave him the benefit of the doubt in this. Maybe he really wanted to believe that, you know, it was just an isolated event.
Yeah, because I think Picard is a character that if he doesn't believe in the best of people, he wants to. And
he wants
to
believe in Maxwell, and he wants to believe that the Cardassians really are innocent.
Yeah, because, you know, you've got that weird part where Galmaset is like, oh, I wanted to make sure you're a man of peace and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, is he snowing him? Like, what is really going on there? You know, and do you get the sense that...
Yeah, there's a... I mean, it's almost a sense of if... I wonder if Galmaset and Picard just don't, you know, are genuinely men of peace, and maybe the Cardassians even feel they need to stockpile the weapons because maybe they have a pile of evidence that suggests that the Federation is doing the same to them. I mean, not that we necessarily believe that the Federation is getting its own arms race, you know, to attack the Cardassians, but, you know, they have enough science projects going on that it's not impossible that they could look at a few things and come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, you get the sense that it is, I mean, this is, you say a Cold War, an arms race. That's exactly what almost seems to be happening there. The war hostilities, both sides want to be done with it, but neither can trust the other. And when you can't trust a former enemy, you really got to gear up because you don't want to be caught unprepared this time. I think that's kind of where they are, and it's almost going to get a tragic dimension then.
Well, we will certainly find out what's going to happen with the Cardassians. Because as I said, they do recur.
We don't have to. We could skip right to Voyager.
No, we're not going to do that.
But Tuvok!
So I will give this 7 glasses of Kanar.
I like Kanar a lot, so I'm giving it 8.
All right. Well, next week, we're going to be talking about Devil's Due and Clues. So look forward to that.